Karen is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Mark Swartzentruber.
On BBC 4 and BBC Radio 3, Symphony. From Mozart and Haydn to Stravinsky and Shostakovich. To complement the new BBC 4 series, BBC Radio 3 presents a month of performances, programmes and downloads exploring a giant musical genre and how it was shaped by the world around it. You can hear complete performances of every symphony featured in the BBC 4 series in Radio 3's Afternoon on 3, weekday afternoons from 2 o'clock.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Anushka Shankar, like her father Ravi, is a master of the sitar. She has created memorable albums such as Adarini, Anushka and Live at Carnegie Hall, and recent albums have featured collaborations with Joshua Bell, Nitin Sawhney. She's also worked with Sting, Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock and the late George Harrison. I think that sort of introduction just shows how wide your interest in music is, Anushka, and I mean how also the music that you love can be open to collaboration and influence from other musicians.
It's one of those things that people don't always anticipate about a style of music like Indian classical music, because in its pure form, of course, it is so different from all Western forms of music, be it in its lack of a harmonic base and being rooted in the raga system, the rhythmic patterns being completely different. But I've tried to model my career in some ways after my father, in the sense that I've always loved that he had on one side a career of a sitarist, and as an instrumentalist he's very pure to the tradition that he belongs to. But then he's allowed himself this entire creative career as well, where he gives vent to all of those desires and could play and experiment and collaborate. And I think that's important. And I think one isn't necessarily at the expense of the other. So I've had a lot of fun, I can say, just kind of using my tradition and the Indian music I've been given to also have dialogues with incredible musicians from all over the place, really.
You're about to tour. In fact, I think you may even have started touring in the UK, and you've got a new album. It'd be lovely just to have a taste of it. Tell us a little bit about it.
On this album, I chose to explore another great musical tradition that I've loved for many years, which is flamenco. So on the album, it's a real mix of Indian classical music and flamenco, and of course, doesn't just sound like those two traditions. Often that gave way to many new sounds coming out. But really, it's an exploration of those traditions and kind of my humble attempt at playing in a flamenco way.
So what are we going to hear?
This piece is called Si No Puedo Verla, and it's a song that I wrote in collaboration with my producer, Javier Limón. And the lyrics are lyrics I actually found in Farsi. They're 13th century lyrics from a statesman called Amir Khusru, who was a very important figure in the Indian arts. And we took those lyrics and had them translated into Spanish. And the part you'll hear, I think, is mainly instrumental. But if you hear the whole song, it does follow in Spanish.
Thank you.
puedo pensarla y soy feliz.
Well, that was a taste of your new album. What's the title of the whole album?
The whole album's called Traveller.
Thank you very much for that. Now, what sort of exposure did you have when you were young to classical music?
I grew up mainly being played a mix of Indian and Western classical music, without necessarily knowing lots about Western classical music. And I was always really drawn towards the piano. And wanted to play the piano as a child. And I think more than the sitar, felt like that was an instrument I wanted to play. And a few years after I started learning the sitar, I did also start learning the piano. And I never progressed as far as I would have liked with it, but it meant a lot to me at the time. I think it kind of felt like an area of music that was completely my own and that was just separate from everything, that was feeling quite daunting as well as being something I loved. And I think that was quite important for me to get to have that.
So did you play the next piece of music?
I did. I was a bit embarrassed when I finally heard it recorded, because that's certainly not how I had played it. I thought it was about just playing it as fast as you possibly could and just used to race my way through it. But
of course, Debussy was a composer who was terribly open to other cultures, wasn't he? I remember reading how influenced he was by the Paris exhibition when there was Gamelan and things like that came. And then he was also influenced by jazz. So this is the Children's Corner, isn't it?
Yes.
And rather than hearing you on this occasion, we're going to hear Philippe Entremont. It's a very joyous piece.
Oh, I just love that piece. I just love it. I find it completely transporting. I was just realizing as it was playing here, actually, because I haven't studied it in this way before, but I wonder if I love it so much because it's almost entirely a single line of melody. And I probably...
With some arpeggiated chords springing from the melody.
Yes, but overall it's just kind of following the single, very quick melody, and I'd probably relate to that as an Indian musician, but I just love that piece so much.
Dr. Grados ad Parnassum, from Children's Corner by Debussy, we heard Philippe Entremont. We were talking about the nature of collaboration, Anushka Shankar, and I think the next one epitomises it for you in some ways.
I think it's one of the best collaborative records I've heard. Again, it's a completely organic collaboration between two musicians who obviously love each other and have a very deep musical relationship. and it's probably one of my most played albums.
Ali Fakature has achieved a quite wonderful kind of worldwide popularity, hasn't he? I mean, he's managed to take music all over the world, and a kind of music that perhaps people were hearing quite often for the first time.
I did. I was certainly one of those people that was exposed to his instrument and to his music through him. Yeah, I mean, it's the sound of the instrument and the sound of the music, but his playing style is so liquid and stunning. I really find it incredibly moving.
But you know that lovely bubbly percussive sound you have in your music? Mm. Here, there are the equivalents, the sounds that... it's almost like spices from a different country.
That's very evocative. I think I can hear the connection between the musicians in the music. It sounds like a musical form where people are really listening to each other and playing off of each other, and there's that kind of dialogue that one feels privy to as a listener, which I find very infectious.
And that's what's always great fun about improvisation, isn't
yes.
it? That feeling something just sparks something.
Absolutely.
And then somebody does something even more amazing in a way, and then
yeah.
you're forced to answer that.
Exactly, and it yeah. pushes you further than you would go alone, I think. And it puts you on the spot, and I think that's important as an artist, that you can't always think ahead or plan what you're doing, and that, I think, gets your head out of the way and leaves room for magic to occur.
And you have to be generous too, because you have to allow the space. You can't just crowd somebody.
No, yeah. That's true.
It's a good model for relationships.
I'll try and take that in.
Thank you. The curious thing about that was that it was basically two chords with one note which is common to both. And that's what gives it a kind of binding feel. And yet they manage to create something very compulsive, don't they?
Well, it's that thing of kind of subtle variations, I think, that keep coming back through the repetition of that main line again and again, and the chora keeps improvising and developing a little bit more, one note and then another note, and that's quite hypnotic, I think.
Monsieur le maire de Niafunke, Ali Fakatore playing the guitar, Tumani Diabate, the chora, and Olekan Babalola, the percussion. Now, the next piece, Anushka Shankar, I think you heard quite recently at St. Luke's.
I did, yeah. It was soon after I moved back to London, and I live a walking distance from St. Luke's, and someone told me they were at a concert at lunchtime, and so I walked over unplanned, and it's such a beautiful venue, you know, that instantly it's so much more beautiful and evocative to hear music in there. I played in there once, and it was, I think, one of my favourites in London. But, yeah, this piece was being played in there, and funnily enough, it's in C sharp. I think it's in D flat, but being in C sharp, I felt like, oh, I'd love to take this piece and try and do a sitar version of it, you know.
So did you know this music at all before?
I didn't.
No?
I didn't know.
Well, it's lovely, isn't it, when you suddenly open a door, literally, and another door is open to a new musical world.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Fauré was a composer who, I think, people always think of him as being quite reserved, but the music breaks out of those boundaries quite often, and especially in the chamber music.
Well, I mean, as someone who wasn't aware of his music at all, I found it incredibly accessible. I mean, it spoke to me anyway.
Well, this is the second movement, the Andantino, from the Trio for Cello, Piano and Violin, Opus 120.
Thank you.
Although the lines in that are so elegant, it builds itself to quite a climax, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I find it really cleansing, that piece. It just seems to, the way it resolves, it just feels like I've really been washed of everything horrible and just feel really at peace. It's amazing.
We heard Gil Shahan playing the violin, Akira Eguchi the piano, and Brinton Smith the cello in the Andantino second movement from Fauré's Trio for Piano, Cello and Violin, Opus 120. I know you studied with your father, Anushka, and having had a father who's a composer myself, I know how difficult it is, actually, that for actually a parent to be rigorous with a child is quite hard, but maybe within your tradition that wasn't so difficult.
I'm sure he would tell you it was still very difficult. Of course, for me, unlike him, it was my only experience of having a guru, of having a teacher and a father. Whereas for him, he was having to alter his entire method of teaching, which he was used to with dozens and dozens of students over decades. And so he definitely would be the one who found it more challenging in that sense.
Well, that's what I imagined, because... Yeah. As you now know, children have a way of getting what they want. And so I imagine that must have posed a slight problem occasionally for him. But maybe not.
I think my mum played a big part as well. So he wasn't entirely alone in teaching me, because even before I began learning sitar from him, she kind of set the scene in a way that she was playing me the music all the time, taking me to concerts. And the two of them together were quite a united front in both telling me that I was not being forced to play, and that even though he was who he was and all of that, that they weren't pressuring me to play, and that it was important. I knew that I could stop anytime I wanted. But simultaneously, they were both united in telling me that if I were to play, it was something that demanded a certain amount of discipline and respect, and it deserved that focus on my part. So I kind of was told again and again at different stages as I got older that I was not being forced, but also that it was something to take seriously. And I think that was quite important, because I loved the music, and I was also very intimidated by it, because I could see that it meant a lot to take on my father's instrument and to learn from him. But he, while being a really exacting teacher and a real perfectionist when it comes to the music, he's also really bewitching, because his love of the music comes across. And
so perhaps he didn't need to be that sort of much of a disciplinarian with you.
At times he did, but overall he was scary enough, just being him, you know. Like, I knew that you couldn't mess around with him. And so we kind of were able to draw these boundaries between us, that if we were in the music room, he was my guru. And if we were, you know, at the dining room, he was my father. And there was a different level of familiarity and joking and talk back that I could do. But if we were learning, then it was completely a different environment.
Well, which piece have you chosen of your father's?
It was difficult to choose one, honestly. I've chosen one from an album called Improvisations, which I think was a real ear-opener for a lot of Western audiences, and when my father was first gaining a name globally. And it's a raga called Kirvani, which is a beautiful raga originally from the South Indian tradition that my father helped to popularize. And it's the type of raga that's explored just as a scale, rather than having a very intensive pattern within the scale. And it lends itself very easily to collaborations with styles outside of the Indian tradition. So it's quite an important raga that way. And it's one of my favorites to play.
And the other instruments that we'll hear are...
The tabla, which is the most popular North Indian percussion instrument.
And that makes that wonderful...
Yes, well, because it's a higher drum and a lower drum that are played in conjunction. Yeah. And so they have a very rich tonality when put together. And then the tanpura is a very subtle but important drone instrument that's an open 4 or 5 string instrument that helps to set the mood, but it also helps to set the key of the piece of music. So it grounds the raga. Based on the drone.
It plays the role that sort of common note in the Anni Fakaturi.
Exactly. Mm. And this piece of music is in a rhythmic cycle called Tintal, which has 16 beats. And if anyone wants to try and count along, I think the tabla starts on the first beat of the cycle, plays a little opening intro. And then my father comes in with the main song, which we call the Gat. And this one happens to start 5 beats before the one. So it starts on the 12th beat.
Thank you.
We heard Ravi Shankar playing Raga Kevani, and he was joined there by, you have to tell me if I get the names wrong here, Kanai Dutta playing the tabla, and Nodu Malik playing the tampura. Sometimes the simplest things are the most elliptical, aren't they, Anushka?
I guess.
I was thinking really of Gymnopédie.
I thought we were being led somewhere, yes.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I agree. I mean, again, what you were saying just now about listening on different levels to a piece of music, and this is probably one of the most well-known pieces of classical music, even among my friends and colleagues that don't know Western classical music at all. And I hesitated a moment before choosing it, actually, because I suppose I wanted to seem a bit more clever and knowledgeable and all of that. But it, simply put, I just absolutely love this piece of music, and I think it's that well known for a reason.
And I guess that the fewer notes there are, the more choices you have.
I think space is really important in music, and I've learned that through making the mistake of forgetting that very often, because as an instrumentalist, I'll think from my own perspective. And in a show or in a piece of music, I'm very quick to want to show my idea, play the next line and move forward. And it's only on listening back that I'll hear the value of holding back a bit more. And pieces of music like this really show me that. It's just so simple.
Because music's all about breath, isn't it? I mean, and you know, none of us can just speak endlessly without breathing. And the same with phrasing. What makes a phrase beautiful is the cadence and then the upbeat. And the space in between is what tells you kind of the rhythm of where you're going.
And it sort of prepares the listener as well, doesn't it, to not have that onslaught, that their kind of palate is cleansed again and again and they're able to take in what comes next.
Thank you.
In a sense, it's the combination of repetition and then the odd surprise, the note that is flattened.
Yeah. It has so much impact, doesn't it? Because, well, now I anticipate that flattened note, but really anticipate the other one. And when it comes like this, it just is so impactful.
So it's like a sudden intake of breath then, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Angela Brownridge played Gymnopédie No. 1 by Erik Satie. You were talking, Anoushka, about your passion for flamenco. And indeed it's flamenco we're going to hear next.
Yes. This is an unusual flamenco musician in that he's actually Italian. His name is Gino Dauri, and I knew him in Los Angeles. And he's a lovely man that played amazing guitar in Cucucumi in Pesto. But he was someone that really was quite influential for me because he helped bring the flamenco tradition a bit closer, because as a friend I would hear him play in much more intimate settings, and kind of my understanding grew through hearing him. He passed away a few years ago, and so as always, when you know someone that has done work like this, it's kind of a mix of hearing the music and also kind of hearing the person in it. So I'm really fond of this recording.
And that transportation across continents, it's rather like the influence of Moorish architecture in Spain, for example. And it produces a kind of hybrid, but which is also something that's totally natural.
It's a strange one, because I feel like so many people think of collaborations and cross-cultural dialogue and music as something so new today, possibly just because of the way in which we're doing it being much more sudden and dramatic. But all of this is stuff that's been happening, of course, through centuries. And I was always surprised when I was younger to learn of the amount of kind of Arab influence in the flamenco music. And it just gives such a weight, doesn't it? A beautiful power to the music, which I find really addictive.
Thank you. There's a bit of Granados and Albéniz in there, I think. One phrase in particular that was Recuerdo de la Alhambra by Gino Darri. And is the album called Flamenco Místico?
It is, yeah, that's the album name.
Now, in this last piece, Anushka Shankar, I think it's as much the voice as the actual song itself that attracts you.
Very much so. I think it's just really sort of plaintive the way he repeats that chorus line again and again, and it's something I find really kind of pulling and very moving. And
Into my arms.
Yes, yeah. And he just kind of says it again and again in a way that it just becomes kind of sweet and pitiful and just really, really loving. And I've only heard that song in the last couple of years. I didn't know it. And so I kind of associate it with my husband and just kind of having heard it through him. And so, of course, that kind of builds it to a whole new level.
You must have quite an interesting influx and cross-fertilization of ideas, because Joe Wright's film director and you're a musician. And so it must be rather fun to come from different disciplines and yet ones that are both very creative.
They do inform each other. I mean, I often kind of will be telling him about someone that I've just heard, and that will end up influencing something that he researches, and vice versa. He'll give me amazing ideas because he thinks in such a different way than I do, and I'll end up being able to take those ideas and translate them musically. And I love that. It's what we talked about earlier about kind of cross-genre influence, and then having it be across the board outside of my own field of art as well. It's just a real education.
And the best cross-referencing of all is a 5-month-old baby.
Yeah, well done. Yeah, you could say that, yeah.
Very appropriate moment to hear Nick Cave's Into My Arms.
In grace and love and guide you into my arms, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my I believe in love. walk down, me and you. So keep your candles burning, make a journey bright and pure, that you'll keep returning always and evermore into my arms, O Lord, into my arms, O Lord, into my arms, O Lord, into my arms.
We were talking about the sanctity of space earlier. And there you had it, par excellence, didn't you? Because it's quite a long verse, and he leaves quite a big rest before into my arms, so that you're really waiting for it. And then even a gap between into my arms, O Lord.
Yeah.
And he has the confidence to take the time, and that actually kind of makes that song, I think.
I hadn't realised that until we heard that after all the other pieces we'd talked about, and as it was playing, I just thought, wow, that is a perfect example of that space, because you do just kind of almost hold your breath and wait for it to come around.
He leaves you on an upbeat, and you're waiting for it to resolve.
Yeah, and it's a very beautiful, that anticipation is as beautiful as the release of it, actually.
Into My Arms, Nick Cave from The Boatman's Call. Well, Anushka Shankar, thank you very much. Good luck with your tour and with the new CD, which sounds very beautiful.
Thank you.
Anushka Shankar was talking to Michael Barclay, and next week on Private Passions, his guest will be the photographic artist Fabian Miller. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
On BBC Radio 3, Free Thinking. A whole evening of programmes from Radio 3's Festival of Debate, Interviews and Bright Ideas at the Sage Gateshead. Tonight from 6:30, Shakespeare, Shelley and Alan Bennett rub shoulders with Schubert, Strauss and Schoenberg in a special edition of Words and Music. Cardiac surgeon Francis Wells discusses the links between art and medicine. And there's a live free-thinking drama on three set during the riots of summer 2011. An evening at Freethinking 2011, tonight from 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the afternoon here on Radio 3. Plenty to come before we head to Gateshead this evening. In a couple of minutes, for instance, the early origins of the symphony are explored in the early music show. That's after a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime. It's read by David Cornett.
An announcement on the formation of a new national unity government in Greece could be made as early as this afternoon, according to sources close to the Prime Minister, George Papandreou. Leaders are in talks in an effort to find a solution to the political deadlock which is holding up the implementation of the Eurozone bailout deal. Earlier, the leader of the main opposition party repeated calls for Mr. Papandreou to stand down. Police investigating Friday night's M5 motorway pile-up say the number of people killed in the crash stands at 7. 51 people were injured in the accident at Taunton in what's been described as Britain's worst road accident for 20 years. Emergency crews have now removed all 34 vehicles involved, and the road is due to reopen at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. There are reports that security forces in Syria have killed at least 10 civilians as anti-government protests continue across the country. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says that most of the deaths occurred in the cities of Homs and Hama. Today marks the first day of the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha. Thai government officials say that more than 500 lives have been lost so far in floods. Waters are continuing to swamp main roads in Bangkok and threaten the city centre. There are fears of possible outbreaks of disease in the capital, with dead animals and industrial waste contaminating the water. The Australian airline Qantas is offering 100,000 free tickets to customers who were affected by last week's snap decision to ground its global fleet. The free return flights within Australia or to New Zealand are expected to cost Qantas £15 million. Offers to other overseas customers are expected to be made shortly. Tour operators are reporting a slump in the number of bookings during next year's Olympics in London. The European Tour Operators Association says ordinary tourists are being put off by, among other things, inflated hotel prices and concern that the capital will be overcrowded. And the weather, it'll be cloudy across southeast England, but dry with good sunny spells elsewhere. There'll be highs of 12 degrees Celsius. Tonight, cloud will spread from the southeast to much of England and parts of East Wales. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
David, thank you very much. Well, in an hour from now, a chance to hear the music of Nicholas Moore in a concert at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London, which was given last Sunday by the Holst Singers and students of the Royal Academy of London, together with the City of London Sinfonia. Our Sunday concert begins at 2. But next, this lunchtime, as part of the BBC's month-long celebration of the symphony, here's Catherine Bott with the Early Music Show.
A sound about as far from early music as you can imagine, Mahler's Symphony of a Thousand. I never really got Mahler until I sang his Das Klagenlied with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and discovered that there is nothing quite like standing in the midst of a symphony orchestra in full cry. Imagine yourself back 150 years or so from Mahler's day. The novelty, the sheer excitement for composers of being able to write music which could bring together a whole orchestra. That irresistible blend of strings, wind, brass and percussion. A combination which music had managed to do without for centuries. Let's go even further back, right to the medieval age and the Renaissance, when apart from the social distinctions between troubadours and trouvères, town waits and courtly minstrels by appointment, there were only two kinds of music, loud and soft, or you could call it outdoor and indoor, played on two different and mutually exclusive kinds of instruments. I'm generalising for brevity, of course, but think about the sounds of, say, a consort of crumhorns versus a consort of viols. In the early years of the Baroque, when opera really got going in Venice, certain instruments had a symbolic role to play, chirruping recorders for amorous shepherds or absent lovers, sombre sackbuts for Orfeo's descent into Hades. So there was orchestral colour right through the music of the 17th century and into the 18th, but usually not without some specific dramatic purpose. The assembling of all the different types of instruments to play a piece together really arose from the development of the concept of the public concert, when music began to move out from exclusive small interiors to large halls, where one of the most exciting challenges was to fill the room with sound. And so the symphony came into being, a word that comes from two Greek ones meaning sounding together. Today's early music show is all about the 18th century symphony, the most important musical form for orchestra. Throughout 18th century Europe, pioneering composers, many of them forgotten today, were writing their own answers to the question of what a symphony might be. Just try to picture what it must have been like 250 odd years ago to hear sounds like these for the first time.